This is side two of session 41, recorded on May 28th, 2007. I just wanted to follow up on that last Kant statement. Kant is K-A-N-T, Immanuel Kant we're talking about. I remember reading years ago, I don't know if it's true or not, that Bob Dylan, when he was in university, read some Kant, the little bit of university education he had. And he learned from Kant that we couldn't know, or something like that. So then he goes out and becomes a figurehead for the counterculture. The counterculture, which LaRue says is an extension of Rockefeller-fostered zero population growth and ecology nonsense. Dylan and Rockefeller funded the counterculture. That is interesting that if that's true, that Dylan was impressed by Kant. He carried on the Kant tradition of the great I don't know, we can't know, mm-hmm. and denied the mind's own coherency. He took it into the musical folk culture.
Right.
It always struck me as funny in light of reading what LaRouche says about
right.
Bob. LaRouche didn't like Dylan.
Mm. I wonder if Dylan read Kierkegaard, because Kierkegaard also philosophized that ultimately we can't know, although he was doing it more from a perceptual level. He thought all this thinking really is stupid. I'm going to perceive and experience the world to its core is what he tried to do. But then he said finally, yeah, but we can't know, but therefore we have to bring faith back. And this was the thing that kind of keeps religion going. Well, if we can't know, then we've got to have faith to fill in the gap. Maybe LaRouche is saying, no, we can know, and therefore faith and religion are unnecessary.
No, LaRouche sees the religion as, well, scientific religion as important.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's interesting that the Vatican might support LaRouche, because as the Vatican realizes technology is inevitable, they got to come up with a thinker who celebrates the Christian conception and celebrates that Galileo was a bad guy and all the stuff that LaRouche writes about. He's the perfect technological liberal to be a transition buffer for the Vatican to adapt to the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
You were saying... Oh,
yeah, I mean, doesn't that imply that you can't know if you got to have religion or faith?
No, LaRouche says you know that this is the best of all possible worlds, and we're going to make it better. And you have faith that you'll overcome the oligarchs. So he
mm-hmm.
politicizes the Christian action,
mm-hmm.
the Christian meme. The thing about Kierkegaard is that maybe how you just described him, he could be seen as the father of existentialism, but definitely... existentialism is an evil force from LaRouche's point of view. Aristotelianism is, in the 20th century, existential.
Yeah.
So Kierkegaard relying on his sensory experience,
right.
That's the opposite of LaRouche's method.
Right. Then we get to Jean-Paul Sartre, who's an existentialist, and he says... All we can know is existence itself, but we can't know anything else because everything else is just narrative. It's just us stringing things together that don't actually go together, but we make it fit because we want to have a narrative.
That's what Sartre says.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know how we're talking about how LaRouche wanted to lead thought he was the leader of the world revolution?
Uh-huh.
Well, his main competitor in the revolution... was Jean-Paul Sartre and the whole tradition that came out of 50s France that led into the postmodernists. He sees them as all extensions of Sartre, and Sartre being the worst Aristotelian guy you could get.
Yeah.
So it was Sartre versus LaRouche.
Yeah.
Now, McLuhan didn't think much of the existentialists either, but he had he didn't really...
But then they ended up picking up on McLuhan and then doing the postmodern thing, evolving out of the existentialism into the postmodern thing.
Yeah, but they all denied McLuhan.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, well, they all restated McLuhan's points and claimed they came up with it. Back to what I wanted to say about McLuhan is that I shouldn't say he didn't like the existentialists. He saw the existentialists as an effect of radio and television as knee-jerk conceptualists confronting the post-conceptual world of electric percept, and that they were just what he would call a reflex. They didn't understand the causes of why they had their philosophical crisis. So when you say that Sartre felt that we were just stringing together fragments of logic or reason, McLuhan would say, well, that's just Sartre realizing the emptiness of the Gutenbergian rational visual space.
And yeah, inside the electric resonating node.
Right. And that Sartre didn't, McLuhan would say, Sartre didn't know that when we turned off the electric environment, we'd go back and think that our thinking via books was real, connected, and logical, and solid.
Yeah. Now, so we just covered Kant and Sartre, Kierkegaard. Kant was actually quite a bit more. He was 1700s.
1780.
Yeah, it's actually Descartes back in the 1600s was the one who really crystallized this dilemma about the I don't know what you say. I don't know if he's called disappearing visual space, but when he was deliberating, you know, that you can't know anything, and he started with the premise, you know, I think, therefore I am. He was saying, well, the only thing that I really can hang my hat on for sure, if I want to start from ground zero, is that I must exist, because how could I know that I was thinking about myself if I wasn't here to notice that I was having these thoughts? So, therefore, I must exist. I'm going to start as that being the only thing I know that's true. And then he started to build up logic from there. I'm sure that LaRouche doesn't like René Descartes either. But
let me say something about that. In his book on dialectical economics, came out in 1975, Lynn Marcus, so I'll have to check. I think it's written by Lynn Marcus. Got to check that. Signed, authored by Lynn Marcus. It's a collection of LaRouche's thinkings about the 60s and the left world and all that he was interested in the late 60s, early 70s. So he wrote it before 75, let's assume. But in that, he makes Descartes a great guy. But by the late 70s, Descartes is a bad guy and an evil Aristotelian. So there's two views of Descartes in LaRouche's evolution.
Yeah, well, that seems inconsistent.
Yeah, well, he does change, as I was saying, when he goes to Germany. He kind of drops a lot of his interest in the left world and puts out a book a couple of years later saying that the whole gang, Marx and everybody, were dupes of the British intelligence service.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when people who knew of LaRouche as being somehow connected to the left, even though they didn't like what he did on the left, in the late 70s, they started saying LaRouche went right-wing. But LaRouche wasn't a simple version of right-wingism. I mean, he criticized all the right-wingers. And the rise of Friedmanite economics in the early 80s, which was part of the Reagan Revolution, and people considered the right-wings take over via the Republican Party, LaRouche was always saying those guys were fools and a continuation of the Aristotelian tradition. So,
yeah.
Again, LaRouche was not your normal right-winger or left-winger.
Yeah. Well, Descartes is born 1596, right after we get the printing press, and just after Shakespeare, flower of the manuscript culture,
yes.
And dies in 1650. Now, why is he contemplating the disappearance of visual space?
No, not the disappearance of visual space. He's changing acoustic medieval space into visual space. He's the one that creates what's properly called the mind-body dualism. He turns existence or ontology into a split situation.
Yeah, so he's kind of the bardo between the manuscript and the book.
Yeah. Well, he really imbibes the visual space effect. It's been around for over 100 years. And, you know, Leibniz is the philosopher of industry. So Leibniz goes past Descartes. So Descartes is in that period of the pure visual effect of the Gutenberg printing press. But then in the late 1600s, early 1700s, you start getting into industry. And that's where Leibniz comes in. And he sees Leibniz sees Newton as a continuation of the visual space effect.
Yeah, Leibniz comes in 1646 to 1716.
Yeah. Okay, so let's...
Same time as Newton. I mean, Leibniz and Newton's are competing with each other, so it's interesting that they have different world perspectives, that the Platonic lineage is still... thread is still alive in Leibniz, while visual space is consensus reality is preferring the visual space of the of Newton.
Being Aristotelianism.
The Aristotelianism, yeah. I mean, there. You know, we could say that the book environment, the visual space is developing. So why is Leibniz even there? But he's still there, but he gets selected against.
Yes, but you can see with the printing press, you can really start categorizing, classifying. You have Linnaeus does all that botany or biology classification, plant life. So the classification, or Aristotelian, as LaRouche defined it, the classification impulse, is really enhanced with the printing press. But you move out of the printing press with the beginning of machinery. And Leibniz represents that, and that's the beginning of kinetic space, in McLuhan's terms. So LaRouche is a pro-kinetic space guy, as I have on my chart.
Mm-hmm.
LaRouche is not limited to visual space. Matter of fact, his whole interpretation of visual space is from a kinetic bias against the eye and all that the eye can do, separate, fragment, classify, which has its benefits, he's down on. And he calls it Aristotelianism.
Yeah, you have him as like an oil guy on your chart, don't you?
Oil guy?
Oral.
No, LaRouche is an oral guy by instinct who is relishing in kinetic and visual space.
Yeah.
Developing it.
Right.
Not just visual space, visual and kinetic, but with an oral bias.
Right, okay.
And oral could be more Platonic, since Plato is the transition from the oral to the visual space of Greek society, and Aristotle is a little bit after him and gets into the less oral and into classification.
Right.
In fact, McLuhan said an interesting thing. He said Plato was a mime who got seduced by visual space. Aristotle was a professional scribe, therefore very involved with visual space, and his philosophy tended to go towards intuition over time, which you might consider oral.
Yeah.
So they both went in the opposite directions. One coming out of orality, Plato, and then really down on his oral roots and banned the musicians from the Republic and goes for the abstract visual space of ideas.
Plato did?
Yeah.
Oh.
He said you couldn't have musicians in the Republic.
Hmm.
And Aristotle is a professional writer, classifier, who in his philosophy starts moving toward oral intuition.
Right.
It's another case individually of east going west and west going east.
Yeah, there's always the complement involved. It's always complementary, the dynamics, I guess.
Right, it's only speech and writing that make these categories and create these dialectical games.
Right, but then one flips and becomes figure and the other becomes ground, and then it flips and the other becomes figure and becomes ground. Weren't we talking about that with Croker last time?
Yeah.
About how the polarities of flip?
Right. And that's working within dialectics.
Yeah.
But that's limited if you don't include the persuasive environmental effects
mm-hmm.
beyond a two polarized figures.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, bringing in the other senses. It's the visual sense that sees a polarity, a fragmentation like Descartes doing mind-body.
Right.
Dialectic.
Yeah.
So let's get back to LaRouche. I want to go on to the next quote.
Okay.
And we're going to move into, he talks about more practical political reality, gets more into the 20th century. And so this quote, the next one, the bottom page 64 and then page 66 of my number system, is the essay, again, we've quoted from here before, The Science of the Human Mind, A Treatise on Fundamentals, LaRouche wrote in February 84, or was published in February 84 in the Campaigner magazine. So you want to read this?
The key is the measurement of usable energy available per square kilometer. The level of biological reproduction potential is determined by the minimum value reached by a continuous supply of usable energy per capita. In what aspect of food-gathering culture, at the most primitive level, is the supply of usable energy for human existence sufficiently concentrated to permit qualitative increase in population density? The answer is fishing. Fishing is in italics. Especially fishing near the mouths of important river systems. The sequence of human development commonly given by anthropologists is 1. Hunting and gathering society, in brackets primitive society, 2. Animal husbandry, 3. Small garden patches supplementing animal husbandry, 4. Agricultural revolution, 5. Quote, hydraulic, unquote, society, urban culture based on water management near the mouths of large river systems. The Diodorus account and other evidence already cited give a different sequence. 1. Fishing. 2. Maritime culture leading into fixed urban settlements based on development of navigation through aid of astronomy. 3. Development of the agricultural revolution by urbanized maritime society. 4. Collapse of wide-ranging maritime culture, shifting the center of culture to a culturally low level based on development of, quote, hydraulic, unquote, societies around colonies of the collapsed maritime culture.
Let me just read the last part. 4. Collapse of wide-ranging maritime culture, shifting the center of culture to a culturally lower level based on development of hydraulic societies around colonies of the collapsed maritime culture. And I forgot to say this was page 41 of that February 84 issue. So what's interesting about this quote is that you know that everybody says we were hunting, gathering, and then we went agricultural.
Mm-hmm.
So LaRouche, being a stick in the mud, is going to not accept that assumption. He says we didn't begin with hunting and gathering, at least in the real evolution of human development. We began with fishing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you mentioned earlier that he liked the maritime cultures. Well,
right.
That's phase two, maritime culture leading into fixed urban settlements based on development of navigation through aid of astronomy, still navigating on the oceans, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then development of the agricultural revolution by urbanized maritime society. 4. Collapse of wide-ranging maritime culture, shifting the center of culture to a culturally lower level based on development of hydraulic societies around colonies of the collapsed maritime culture. Now, I think he says that happens in the Ionic phase of Greek culture, Greek history. Ionia, I think it is, or Iona.
Is it Greek or Crete?
Greek.
Okay.
He talks about the philosopher Thales comes out of the Ionian culture, and that's before Athens, what we know as the time of Socrates and Plato. And so that's, say, 200 years before. And that was the last vestiges of a very evolved culture, and then it goes downhill until Plato and his gang get the Renaissance going, the Greek rebirth. But what's interesting is that LaRouche says all the stories of the gods, the Olympic gods and the Homeric myths, are a degradation of the advanced maritime culture before Ionia. And so that whole Greek mythology was just, in 20th century terms, just a bunch of pop culture based on the collapse. It was degraded knowledge and belief systems.
Real observations of nature turned into mythological anthropomorphication.
Right, and it's the result of the collapse of the maritime culture, say, going way back. And I think LaRouche even talks about Atlantis as an advanced culture that Plato celebrated, was a maritime culture. So when
wasn't,
you get...
Between Atlantis and the Greek maritime guys, wasn't China the earliest player?
Oh, yeah. It depends on where you date Atlantis. It, I don't know if LaRouche would... I doubt if he would go with Edgar Cayce or whoever the New Agers are that say it's about 10,000 B.C. I don't know if LaRouche would say it's that far back, but he likes Plato, so Plato talks about Atlantis, so he accepts the Atlantis fact. But I'm just using Atlantis as a term to refer to an advanced maritime culture. And after the collapse of Atlantis, at some point, you're getting really a degraded culture, and that's what we think is the cultural development at that point,
mm-hmm.
the Homeric mythology world, and that is a world in its own right and not a sign of degraded culture, as LaRouche would have it.
Right.
So, anyways, what do you have to say about this section?
Well, the projection of all the Olympians, actually I think he's going to talk about that a little more here, so maybe I won't make a comment on it right now. Well, I will say that it's like with the mythology and the gods and stuff, it's like we're taking our inner dynamics, power and politics, and projecting them out onto the environment around us, whereas the maritime guys weren't doing that. They were making quote-unquote objective observations of the stars and
the technology that they used.
Yeah.
So when you say a projection of our inner self, that would be, from Lucia's point of view, a degraded psychological view of what they were going on.
Yeah, taking the group or collective ego and projecting it out on the world onto First Nature, and then believing that... that's how First Nature works, but that LaRouche believes in First Nature, that it really does have principles. So if you're going to project a fog of personal preferences onto real principles, you're really deluding yourself.
Yeah, I don't know if it's personal preferences. It's a natural Malthusian or Thomas Hobbesian way of thinking that there's not enough to go around and everybody's just a brutish animal and we're not going to get out of the supply of food and technology we have and we're not going to move beyond it because with the myth of Prometheus, who was punished for trying to develop new technology, taking the fire away from the gods, that whole meme, that whole trend of thinking, style of thinking, is that you're stuck in your development as it is and you're a prisoner of certain impersonal forces that are controlling you.
Yeah.
And so the idea of mythical gods running your culture.
Well, it's like...
let me just finish. Is updated when you say we're run by the Federal Reserve interest rate. It's the same principle, LaRouche
yeah,
would say.
Yeah. Yeah. Where you're projecting the collective superego, the infant relates to mom and dad as being, you know, the... you know, what they need, you know, is being the probably where the development of the superego begins, because the infant is dependent on mom and dad. And then you take that super collective superego, project it out onto the stars and into the world around you, and think that that's what's managing your life. You've just given up personal responsibility.
Yeah, you don't develop beyond the infantile
exactly.
mindset.
That's the point I wanted to make. You don't develop beyond the infantile mindset.
Yeah, and you always have parents. And
yeah.
LaRouche goes on in other writings about we are mother dominated.
Yeah,
you know, the sense of suckling from the mother and never getting out of that.
Right, and in particularly
the relationship.
Yeah, and particularly in. For the boomer generation, Robert Bly was writing a lot about the mother fixation because dad went away, he went off to work, and the kids were raised by mom, and there was no dad around. So they really, mom became the only God available, and but then that probably changed with subsequent generations where mom and dad both go to work and kids not being raised by either of them.
Right.
Being raised by the TV.
Yeah, now Robert Bly is a figure of prominence in the counterculture New Age world that LaRouche sees as evil and Aristotelian. So LaRouche would tell Mr. Bly, it's not because these kids were subject to a fatherless home and mother domination, is that they weren't given the proper education where they could retrace the studies and inventions of laboratory and science evolution and get the original discoveries in their mind and then want to create more stuff. So LaRouche blames it on the cultural curriculum, not on psychological dynamics that you're referring to. That's why LaRouche doesn't like Freud or Jung. That's a distraction from the basic, we could say from McLuhan's point of view, the medium is the message. Technology is the message, and that's what LaRouche says you must work with. And that's the cause of everything.
Yeah.
All the problems is, if you stop that technological evolution, your society gets in trouble.
Yeah. Well, remember we went through a whole series of conversations of the evolution of the unconscious from the unconscious splitting off at when language first began, and then turning into a personal, and then a collective unconscious, and then a technological unconscious, and with...
That was in Thompson.
Yeah, with the Thompson thing. And maybe LaRouche is saying we could have avoided all that unconscious stuff if we just had the right educational process on down through history. But given what did happen with the educational process and the perception of the world around us, the unconscious had to split off and take on these different forms during the evolution of the technology of language from spoken to visual to post-visual.
Well, LaRouche talks about the unconscious in earlier quotes we did, 8 months ago. I don't want to go back.
Yeah, and he talks about it in terms that are derogatory.
Well, something to be developed, not that you're ruled by it. But the interesting thing here is that in this, he says to look at cultural history in phases, like the classical period, and then the Dark Ages, and then the Renaissance, and then the neoclassical and painting, say, and then the Romantic movement, and then the Symbolist movement, and then the modern art movement. To see history in these cultural phases is Aristotelian.
Mm-hmm.
LaRouche doesn't break up history into these phases. He says it's always the same battle.
Yeah.
At least once we became civilized, which began with Egypt, let's say, or Atlantis, whatever maritime culture LaRouche would name, it begins from that point on. It's a battle between those that don't want a new technological improvement and those that do.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always the same battle. And so LaRouche says that you live in the timeless when you understand that, that Plato and Riemann and Shakespeare and Nicholas of Cusa and Moses are all your contemporaries because they all operate in the same space that you are in.
Mm.
It's timeless.
Buddha, too, or he doesn't like the Buddha?
I don't think he sees, he likes the, he says there are some good developments in Sanskrit culture.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Vedanta, right?
Right. And he sees Greek, Hebrew and Greek coming out of Sanskrit, I think, doesn't he?
Yeah, Sanskrit had some influence, but I don't know. I haven't seen him talking about Buddha. Or he likes Confucius.
Yeah.
As opposed to Lao Tzu.
Yeah.
The popular Zen guy Lao Tzu of the counterculture is anathema to LaRouche. That guy just got people running around.
He's the Taoist, almost existentialist guy.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas Confucius was managing society and was bringing in important principles that helped China.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know about Buddhism per se.
What does he say about Christ, Jesus? Does he think that Jesus is the linchpin for the whole thing, or what does he say about
Jesus? Yeah, he makes a very interesting statement about Jesus. He says that the Platonic tradition done by Plato and the other Platonists, Socrates, Plato, and the rest of them down to the time of Jesus, they, in a sense, were elitists. They didn't think that everybody could become a genius.
Yeah.
And LaRouche, I remember reading this, you know, way back in the 80s or something, way back there. It was an interesting statement. He said that Jesus democratized the Platonic tradition.
Mm-hmm.
He said anybody should be able to become a genius.
Yeah.
In LaRouche's terms of genius. In other words, become someone progressive and not tolerating the money changers and is working for improvement, technological improvement of society. That's the real Christian mandate. But Jesus democratized it.
Mm-hmm.
Let thinkers and remember, and you know, that weren't that many people reading and thinking back then.
Mm-hmm.
So this minority had to get out of its elitist position and include everybody in the program.
Right.
That's what he said Jesus brought in. It was called love of mankind, right, and all that, and agape, that phrase or term, word.
Right.
That's what Jesus accomplished. And then his disciples were great Platonists who spread the word.
Yeah, and then unfortunately the effects of Jesus was Christianity, which destroyed the classical period and scientific development for 1,000 years.
Right, that's he says that's when Aristotle was the oligarchic church for 1,500 years, was its main philosopher.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, he says Nicholas of Cusa, who's about 1,400, was a great breakthrough. And he has other people, Charlemagne. There were different breakthroughs every now and then. But basically, the Venetian oligarchy ran the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Aristotelian, and therefore we had no progress for 1,500 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's ironic that, you know, that Jesus comes. He's like the nexus, the big breakthrough, and then the effects of that big breakthrough are everything gets screwed up even worse.
Well, LaRouche explains that Jesus comes in, he's another Platonist, and he starts a revolution going, and the fight never ends, and the Platonists lose often.
Mm-hmm.
So they lost.
Yeah.
And so LaRouche shows the ongoing fight and shows the winners and losers, and for 1,000 or more years. St. Augustine was a great guy from LaRouche's point of view. And you didn't really get any real breakthrough until the Renaissance, 1450, led by Nicholas of Cusa, who most people don't even know about. And he's a cardinal of the church, so the Vatican probably likes that the idea that the Renaissance was begun by Nicholas of Cusa. But LaRouche says the first time a republic is established and in a solid situation is the United States. And
mm-hmm.
that's the big breakthrough in human history.
Right.
That the Renaissance got tromped by the Venetian forces around 1500 on into the wars between the new Protestant Reformation, which LaRouche sees as was an operation set up by the Venetians to fragment Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So these religious wars, and
yeah, but it helped to break the sort of the Catholic Church was becoming too.
No! Wait a minute. Now, in LaRouche terms, the Catholic Church had a good faction in there, but the good faction was controlled by the Venetians, and the Venetians were worried about the Platonic faction in the Roman Catholic Church, so they created the Protestant Reformation to create a problem for the good faction in the Catholic Church.
Uh-huh.
So LaRouche is always seeing these factions in every institution,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
It's a dichotomizing way of looking at reality, but that's what he's doing. And he really puts incredible importance on the successful American Revolution, because that's the first time you have a republic that is not subject to the European oligarchs.
Mm-hmm. But he doesn't like capitalism, does he?
Well, he doesn't think in those terms. He believes in technology.
But he would you say he's a constitutionalist? Does he believe in the founding
fathers? No, he believes in government banking. Let's call it that way. He says that we'd nationalize the Federal Reserve, and we would declare global bankruptcy, and then we would fund those businesses, whether you call them capitalists or whatever, that were instrumental in keeping the technology development that we already have, and then find the new companies that develop new stuff and emphasize machine tools and not like computer development like Bill Gates does.
Mm-hmm.
emphasize modern machinery to make better tractors for better agriculture, all that whole, what he calls the FDR program, you know, Roosevelt program.
Do you think he would want to suppress the development of the virtual space computer matrix stuff?
Yeah, he would, I don't know if he'd suppress it, but he would not fund it. So what you have is you have government working with business, which is a normal state capitalism, maybe, a normal functioning capitalist, semi-capitalist economy. With an intelligent government, you wouldn't cut the government. You wouldn't bring in, make it the ideal neocon principle is we need as little government as possible. LaRouche believes that the government is responsible for the welfare of the people. So you always got to have government to fund the hospitals and the stuff that business couldn't do.
Yeah.
So it's a traditional Roosevelt platform, and he said Kennedy carried it on. So LaRouche is, in that sense, practical. He's not capitalist or socialist, whatever.
Right.
He says we must move forward with the American system of Republican science and technological development and head toward Mars.
Right. But he probably really likes the guys that said all men are created equal. So I imagine he's behind the Constitution and the Declaration.
Oh, yeah. That's right. He says he's always going after Antonin Scalia and those guys, the neocons on the Supreme Court, as, you know, total fascists who violated the Constitution.
Yeah.
And its principles. But he says the main point in the Constitution is the phrase the general welfare, the idea of taking and protecting the general welfare,
mm-hmm.
which means you have to have a government institution to do that.
Right.
So maybe on a crude level, he'd be seen as a closet leftist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Does he believe
the leftist that he was in the 50s and 60s?
Does he believe in good and evil, or would you just say he believes in knowledge and ignorance?
Yeah, he's against the Manichaean vision of good and evil, but he does think that the principle for good is the technological, scientific, Republican, Platonic tradition. That's good. And to the degree you don't have that, you've got bad. But
does he believe there's, like, dark Satanistic forces at hand?
He'll use those terms in his writings. But he means the Malthusian, Hobbesian, Darwinian, the Rockefeller oligarchic
trend. Right. Not a transcendental being called Lucifer.
I don't know. I once read something he did on the Apocalypse or the Book of Revelations, and he talked about it was sort of a secular way that the beast was always the oligarchs of your time. It wasn't something coming. It was already happening at the time of Christ and in the medieval period and in the time of Shakespeare. Always was the whore of Babylon.
Right.
So it's a concept, but it's not something that he fetishizes.
Yeah. And just one more thing before we move on. Why does he like Augustine? Augustine?
Well, he was... I haven't read too much. They did a whole book on Augustine, or they have a collection of letters. Don't know if I read that part, but just Augustine was a Platonist, and he established the medieval curriculum.
Okay.
What LaRouche calls the, McLuhan calls the trivium and quadrivium, and the grammarian and rhetorical tradition. That's what McLuhan says Augustine did, and I think LaRouche likes Augustine because he's at the end of the collapse of the oligarchy of that day, the Roman Empire. This is like 450, I think, A.D., and that he brought together the remnants of the Christian legacy, 400 years of Christian culture, and he set out the plan for the city of God and said we could do it on earth, I guess. So that would be like building a Republican principle, and that's what Augustine created that meme through the Dark Ages.
Does he like Thomas Aquinas?
No, he says Aquinas was an Aristotelian and botched it, and he says that Aquinas recanted on his deathbed.
Oh, wow.
I don't know enough about Aquinas. What'd you say?
I was just saying, oh, wow, because that's meat and potatoes for Joyce and McLuhan.
Well, he doesn't like Joyce, and he never liked McLuhan.
Yeah.
There was an article.
It's just that these geniuses could, you know, one of them could honor the, you know, Aquinas, and another one could see him as being a bad influence. It's kind of interesting.
Right, but they both have eccentric views of Augustine and Aquinas. You know what I mean? Their thinking about these figures is probably not what's accepted in the normal knowledge institutions and academias and universities.
Right.
They're both idiosyncratic in what they see in these people. I mean, McLuhan went around St. Michael's College in Toronto complaining that the Thomists, which, you know, are followers, they're the Catholic priests there and teachers, were followers of Thomas Aquinas. They're called Thomas, T-H-O-M-I-S-T-S. So they didn't know what they were doing. He was always criticizing them. And those guys would say, well, McLuhan has no right to talk about theology. He has no training in it.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't get along.
Yeah.
It's like McLuhan was the LaRouche of the little university environment there in Toronto.
Yeah.
Just as LaRouche was the outsider here in New York City.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
but I feature them because they take the traditional memes and create new patterns about them, which makes them mind-stimulating.
McLuhan analyzed Aquinas based on his spin or his tweak on the development of language, I suppose, and not thinking in terms of Christian theological. And LaRouche is looking at Aquinas based on how he tweaked, you know, potentially the development of science, I suppose.
Yeah. So you weren't saying, wow, the fact that Thomas Aquinas recanted on his deathbed. You were just talking about how...
Well, that's a big wow, too, if it's true.
Yeah, I don't know if it's true.
Yeah.
That's the thing. A lot of LaRouche's statements are not backed up. A lot of them are backed up, but a lot of interesting things, like he says that Aristotle set up the murder of Alexander the Great. Now, where's the proof of that?
Yeah.
You know? And they've done there was one guy, maybe this Warren Hammerman guy we were just talking about, he did a whole article on that period, I think, and he kind of speculated, saying, you can see it this way and that, you know, and juxtaposed some different historical semi-facts and tried to make the pattern. But many times LaRouche says things that you can't prove.
Yeah.
As the Evergreen said about LaRouche, he often becomes what he beholds. The thing he points his finger at, he becomes.
Oh. Hmm. Yeah. So
he was a speculator of history. He speculated like the Freemasons.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But
very
this,
cool.
But this is interesting about seeing fishing as the ground of technological development.
Yeah.
And it's italicized for some reason.
Yeah.
But let me read this quote again.
Yeah.
And redo it, and we'll go on to the next quote.
Right.
This is, again, from Science of the Human Mind, February 1984. And in that issue of The Campaigner, it is page 41. He says, the key is the... Okay, and as you hear this, remember, we're talking about how is technology proven beneficial? It allows you to create more people in smaller spaces. They successfully survive in more dense population areas.
Mm-hmm.
All right? So he says, the key is the measurement of usable energy available per square kilometer. That's how you tell whether you're progressing. You got a lot more usable energy per square kilometer. The key is the measurement of usable energy available per square kilometer. The level of biological reproduction potential is determined by the minimum value reached by continuous supply of usable energy per capita. Biological reproduction, that's people, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can have more people if you've got constant supply of usable energy. In what aspect of food gathering culture at the most primitive level is the supply of usable energy for human existence sufficiently concentrated to permit qualitative increase in population density? The answer is fishing, especially fishing near the mouths of important river systems. So he's saying that the earliest technological enterprise for such a primitive level of society had to be, if they were to progress, had to be fishing.
Mm-hmm.
The sequence of human development commonly given by anthropologists is, one, hunting and gathering society, in brackets, primitive society.
Now, fishing could be ocean or lake or stream, I suppose. But yeah, he's thinking more in terms of ocean, because that's where your navigation, maritime comes in.
No, he's saying the most primitive society, they just get to the river.
Oh.
Remember, it says especially fishing near the mouths of important river systems. So
well, the mouth is close to the ocean, so it's your borderline maritime, I guess.
Yeah, but at the most primitive level, they have much, I'm assuming he's saying a food-gathering culture. In what aspect of food gathering? So they are food gathering.
Yeah.
So sort of like hunter or food gatherers at the most primitive level.
Right.
What aspect is the supply of usable energy for human existence? In other words, a flowing river, sufficiently concentrated to permit qualitative increase in population density. It would have to be a river.
Yeah.
With constant food coming, because you don't have any technology to make food.
Right.
So you haven't developed boats yet, let's assume.
Yeah.
You're just out of the ape phase, and you start working with fishing. That's your first technological breakthrough. And so many cities maybe come out of river systems, right?
Right.
Like the Nile. So he says, the sequence of human development commonly given by anthropologists is 1, hunting and gathering society, in brackets, primitive society, then animal husbandry, that's 2, then 3, small garden patches supplementing animal husbandry. This is what the Aristotelians say, so to speak. And then, 4, agricultural revolution. Then 5, hydraulic society, hydraulic in quotes, urban culture based on water management near the mouths of large river systems. So that's at number 5, whereas Lewis says it has to be number 1.
Yeah.
The Diodorus, so I guess some scholarly account, the Diodorus, D-I-O-D-O-R-U-S, Diodorus account and other evidence already cited give a different sequence. When he says already cited, that's another part of the article that I haven't included in my quote. So the Diodorus account and other evidence already cited give a different sequence. 1, fishing first. 2, maritime culture leading into fixed urban settlements based on development of navigation through aid of astronomy. 3, development of the agricultural revolution by urbanized maritime society. So the agricultural revolution comes after this navigation. 4, collapse of wide-ranging maritime culture, shifting the center of culture to a culturally lower level based on development of hydraulic societies around colonies of the collapsed maritime culture.